I tucked my notes away with all the missionary letters down there, so. Okay. Might get used to this. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, if we wanted to follow Jewish tradition, you guys would all stand up while I preach, and I'll sit down. I like this. Just a thanks again to Ed and Dan for taking things last week. It is a blessing to know there's men in the church who can take those roles and lead when the time comes and do it well. You know, if it happens that I'm away or that we're sick or something, you know, the worship of the saints can go on here, and we praise the Lord for that blessing. So thanks again, fellas, for jumping in on that at the last minute. We didn't know what we had. I had been sick for a couple of days there, and I actually hadn't seen anybody since the Sunday before our communion Sunday. Was the last time I'd seen anybody here. So Wednesday I started feeling a little blue, and so I called Eldon, and he took Wednesday night for me, and I figured it was just flu. And then Eldon called and said he was not feeling good. He was going to go in and get tested, and I said, well, okay, we'll get one of those home tests and take it and see what it says. And I'm pretty sure that as I breathed on the test, it registered. You know, I didn't even have to mix all the solutions together. It was pretty positive. And, you know, you put the drops of fluid on the test, and you watch the test strip go up, and it was like, bing, bing, you know, all the red lights. I think it phoned into the health department, too, while I was. But we were obviously infected with COVID there, and so That helped make a decision last week, because I was wrestling. I felt okay last Saturday. I'm trying to decide. So I'm not 100%, but, you know, should I try to make it to service tomorrow, or should I ask Ed and Dan to take things for me? And of course, that answered the question. Like, well, no, you shouldn't be at church tomorrow. You should be home, and so should the rest of the family now. So that's where we were, and everybody's feeling pretty good now. I can say we're symptoms are gone, other than just still a little run down, but all the headaches and aches and fevers and things like that have finished their course. And Hannah and Abby are the last ones to finish their quarantine period, and they'll finish up tomorrow. And Hannah has to call and answer a few questions from the folks at Hobby Lobby, and then they said they'll probably let her come back to work on Tuesday. And so that's where we are. But I thought I would share with you something that actually I was preparing for last week and then didn't get to use. And so it still fits very well with our Christmas theme. And that is what Paul says in Galatians chapter 4, verses 4 and 5. When the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. It's one of those interesting verses that can take a lot of thought. What does he mean by when the fullness of time came? Why is it that our calendar gets divided into two very distinct periods of history? Of course, they're trying to change that a little bit. I don't know if you've noticed the trend. They don't talk about BC and AD anymore. They talk about BCE and CE. Of course, BC means before Christ. AD means in the year of our Lord. It's a Latin term, Anno Domini. I know for years and years I thought that meant after death, right? I said, what do you do with the 30 years in between? But But the academics are trying to switch things now to talk about the current era and before the current era. It still divides at the same spot, but they just don't want to reference it as the year of our Lord anymore, which is just part of the ongoing rebellion of mankind against God and his rule and against Christ. And it'll continue until he returns and puts down all rebellion. But our calendar does divide. It has for quite a while. It was back in the 4th century, I think, when the Pope commissioned some folks to look into when was the year of the birth of Christ. We're going to switch calendars. Because up until that time, the calendar that was mostly in vogue was the Roman calendar, which dated from the founding of the year of Rome in 753 BC. And as the church was growing and Christianity was becoming the rule of faith of most people throughout Europe, they started to say, well, there's something a lot more monumentous in the world than the founding of the city of Rome, and that is the birth of our Savior. And so let's form a whole new calendar around it, and they did. We've been using that ever since. But Paul makes this statement that it was at the fullness of time when God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law. And I thought I would just take a little bit today and we'll talk about what does it mean that the fullness of time had come. Why did the calendar switch at that point? Why was it then that God said, it's time to send my Son to become man? Why was it then that Christ took on himself the form of a servant and became one of us? What constitutes the fullness of time? Well, in order to appreciate what we're going to talk about, we have to remind ourselves of a couple of facts that the Bible is very clear on and reminds us of pretty frequently, actually, because we tend to forget it. And that is what Isaiah says in Isaiah 46, verses 9 to 10. Remember the former things of old, for I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will accomplish all my purpose. One of the things Isaiah loves to point out for us is that God gives us prophecies to let us know before it happens that he's planning to do it, so that when it happens, we'll realize who did it. There won't be any question in our minds that it was God's purpose to accomplish this plan because he told us before it happened. God seems to delight in doing that, telling us things long before they happen. The book of Isaiah contains many references to the coming of Christ, even if you're not talking about other fields of prophecy, just talking about the birth of Christ. Most of the things that we quote in the New Testament, like the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, that's Isaiah. And he'll be the son of David, that's Isaiah. And the government and the increase of his government, there shall be no end, that's Isaiah. A lot of prophecies regarding the birth of Christ that come from the book of Isaiah, because this was Isaiah's ministry to the people of Israel was, I want to tell you ahead of time what I'm going to do so that you'll know who's doing it. Israel was really wrestling with, are they going to believe in Jehovah God, or are they going to follow the gods of the nations? And so God keeps giving them these little clues. I say, well, I want you to think about this. Who can declare the end from the beginning? Can these other gods tell you things that are going to happen 750 years before they happen? No, they can't. But God can do that. And so this principle that God knows the end all the way from the beginning is a solid biblical principle and one that we have to remember. When you're talking about the fullness of time, that's going to all be rooted in the sovereignty of our God, the God who does according to his own purposes and plans, the God who accomplishes his own will, the God who plans, and no one can change it. He says there at the end, my counsel shall stand, and I will accomplish all my purpose. It's one of the things we worship about our God, that there's nothing that can turn his plan. Nothing can stop it. Nothing that's outside of it, nothing that's outside of his purview. He knows all things, and he has a plan for all things. And so even though I had other plans for the last 10 days, God didn't. He knew exactly what was going to happen. He knew what was coming. And he knew what was in store. And so those things are God's prerogative as the God who rules all things. So that has to influence our understanding of what it means by the fullness of times had come. And so we say that just so that we don't think that God was sitting around waiting for just the right circumstances to come about. Our God doesn't sit around and wait for things to happen. Everything happens according to his purpose. Everything happens according to his predetermined plan. Paul tells us similarly in Acts 17. He made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods in the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is not actually far from each one of us. That God even rules in the histories of nations. It's not just that God rules in the small things of life, and it's not just that God rules in the big things of life. God rules in all things. And so he has purposes and plans for accomplishing the salvation of people. He has purposes and plans for the nations of the world. He has purposes and plans for the individuals in the world as well. And those are things we do well to remember. The theme of the book of Daniel, this gets repeated several times throughout Daniel's little prophetic writing, is the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whom he will and sets over it the lowliest of men. That was a very important message for the people of Israel because they were facing a time when their own national sovereignty had come to an end. And Israel had begun a time of being subjected to Gentile leaders, starting with the Babylonians. But while that was happening, God was reminding his people, say, I am not out of control. And in fact, the reason you are under the control of Gentiles is because I'm disciplining you. And I have a purpose for this, and I'm going to accomplish my purpose. But the fact that these Gentile nations are in charge of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem lies in ruins, is not a sign that God is out of control. And it is in the book of Daniel, we're going to spend quite a bit of our time today, because Daniel unfolds that theme, the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, and gives us an awful lot of information about what God's purpose for the history of the world actually is. Once again, telling us things that happen long before they happen, so that when they happen, we'll know whose purpose it is. The book of Daniel is so precise in some of its prophecies that many modern scholars have completely disregarded it as a prophetic book, and they say it must have been written in the 2nd century BC because it prophesies too specifically many things that happen between when it claims to have been written and the 2nd century. It talks about the rise and fall of several world empires that, if it were just a humanly written book, there's no way Daniel could have known those things were going to happen. And yet, he talks about them in detail. And so even today, many modern scholars reject the dating of the book of Daniel, and they say it couldn't have been written when it says it was written. It had to have been written much, much later after the things happened. And that's a shame that they take that stance. We want to take a look at several of the prophecies that Daniel gives us to sort of build this idea of what was the fullness of time. Why was it at that point in history that God sent Christ? And the first one we come to in Daniel chapter 2, you'll read about Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, who has deported many of the Jewish people from Jerusalem and brought them to Babylon. Now, Daniel and his friends were probably deported in 605 BC. That's the year Nebuchadnezzar became king of Babylon. He defeated a conglomerate army of Egypt and Assyria at a battle called Carchemish, a very major battle in the ancient world. And it established the Neo-Babylonian Empire as the big dog in the world. They became the chief world power because of that battle. And after that battle, Nebuchadnezzar stopped by Jerusalem and took away the brightest, best young men in the kingdom. And among those people were Daniel and his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were taken back to Babylon. They were prepped to be Babylonian officials. And you know the story of them refusing to eat the Babylonian foods and things. They turned out to be men of great character because of their faith in Jehovah God. Well, at some point, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up in his pride, God gives him a dream to humble him a bit. Because God consistently tells Nebuchadnezzar, I'm trying to teach you this lesson, that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and sets over them whomsoever he will. See, Nebuchadnezzar had a problem that's kind of intrinsic to most world leaders, and that is they think they rule. They think they're in charge of everything. They think their will is what reigns supreme. And God reminds Nebuchadnezzar several times, no, that's not true. I've done this. And so he gives Nebuchadnezzar this dream, and Nebuchadnezzar calls on all the wise men of Babylon to interpret it, actually plays a fun little game with them and says, I'm not even going to tell you what the dream is. You have to tell me the dream and the interpretation. And of course, only God can do that. And so God, through Daniel, tells Nebuchadnezzar, here's the dream. You saw this statue with a head of gold. The chest and the arms were made of silver. The waist and the thighs were made of bronze, and the legs were made of iron, the feet made of iron mixed with clay. And he tells Nebuchadnezzar, this image that you saw is representative of the history of the world. God is summing up for Nebuchadnezzar what God plans to be doing in the empires of the world. Now, it is very rare that God ever pulls back the veil of the future and lets us see anything by describing his purposes, but at this point, he does. And so he tells Nebuchadnezzar, you, Nebuchadnezzar, are the head of gold. That's Babylon. The chief of the kingdoms, the chief of the empires of the ancient world. The most valuable. You're on top of it all. But there's going to come a series of kingdoms because even the great Babylon is going to come to an end at some point, and it's going to be taken over by another kingdom, represented by silver. Not quite as valuable, but still, yeah. I mean, if I have to take silver, I'll take silver if I can't get gold, right? It's still pretty valuable, still beautiful. And that's going to represent the kingdom of the Medo-Persians, which eventually did conquer the Babylonian Empire. Now, in other prophetic books, God is very clear. He tells Babylon, I'm going to actually discipline you for how you treated my people. I'm using Babylon to discipline Israel for their disobediences to my law, but I'm going to use other nations to discipline these empires because of their manner of doing it. And so the Babylonian Empire lasted from 605 until 536 BC. That was the period of time under which the 70 years that Israel was in subjection to the Babylonian Empire. And when the Babylonian Empire fell to the Medo-Persian Empire, the new king of the Medo-Persians, Cyrus, released all the Jewish people and allowed them to go back to Jerusalem and to begin to rebuild the temple. And that ended their period of subservancy to Babylon. Of course, they were still under the control of the Medo-Persian Empire. And the Medo-Persian Empire lasted for several hundred years, from 536 BC until about 331. And again, God told Daniel all this long ahead of time. He didn't give exact dates for it, but he told them the things that were going to happen. In other passages in the book of Daniel, he describes these world empires as animals. And so the kingdom of Babylon is represented as the eagle. The kingdom of Medo-Persia is represented as a bear, and the next kingdom, Greece, represented as a leopard coming up out of the west. Well, in 334 BC, a young man from Macedon crossed the Hellespont into Asia and began conquering. He was unstoppable. His name was Alexander the Great. He was the son of Philip, the king of Macedon. And he had it set in his mind that he wanted to rule the world from the Mediterranean all the way to the great outer ocean, which would have been the Pacific. And so he set about on a series of campaigns that in 10 years have conquered nearly the entire inhabited world. It was an astounding thing for the world to see. to think of the changes that came because of the conquering of Alexander the Great. It's hard for us to imagine. But that is the waist and the thighs of bronze, Greece. So he crossed the Hellespont in 334. It was several years later in 331 when Alexander the Great finally conquered the Medo-Persian king and took over the Medo-Persian empire for himself. Well, Alexander only lived 10 years after that. He died, left no heir to the throne, and so his grand kingdom started to fall to pieces. It split into four and was ruled by his four generals. And actually, if you read Daniel chapter 7, you'll get a very good description of the goings-on of these two of those four generals and how it impacted the Holy Land, which was sandwiched between these two. One of them ruled from Egypt, the other ruled from Syria. And they were the Ptolemaid and the Seleucid Greek kingdoms. And Jerusalem was caught right in the middle of all that for the next couple of hundred years, from 331 until 64 BC. For a short period of time, the Jewish people were able to regain their independence under the Maccabean revolt, or we call it the Hasmonean dynasty of Jewish leaders. Judas Maccabeus rebelled against the Seleucid Greek Empire, and he managed to win Jewish independence, and for many years they existed as an independent kingdom again. But then in 63 BC, or 64 BC, another empire begins marching across the world. Well, it's been marching for a little while, but it took until 64 to get to Jerusalem, and that is the Romans. And in 64 BC, Judea fell to the Roman rule. They couldn't resist those iron legions. And Nebuchadnezzar's dream was shown to be God's purpose and plan for the Jewish people who were to be ruled by these different kingdoms. Now, those legs of iron grow naturally into the feet that are mixed iron and clay. That kingdom has yet to come about. That is Antichrist's kingdom. It plays a big part in the events of the book of Revelation. Daniel does describe some of it. But most of Daniel's descriptions for us relate to the period of time between the New Testaments and the things that will be going on there. And so this statue gives us, in a summary sort of way, a description of the history of the empires of the world as it relates to the Jewish people until the coming of Christ. And it forms for us in a very picturesque way God's purposes and plans for what it means for the fullness of times to come. But again, that statue is not a very detailed description. It tells us that there's basically four major world empires coming: Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome, before the end comes. Because that statue, if anybody remembers what happened to it, it says a rock not made with hands fell upon that statue and destroyed it. And then that rock grew and became a kingdom that covered the entire earth. Well, that rock is Christ. That picture is that Christ is going to be the one to dismantle all of the kingdoms of the world. Though they build upon themselves, though they continue to gain in strength, yet Christ is going to be the one to rule over all of them. And so we wait for that day when Christ will rule the kingdoms of this world. But in Daniel chapter 9, as Daniel is getting to be a very old man, and he is studying his scriptures, he finds out about the period of time known as the 70 years captivity. He's reading the book of Jeremiah. He realizes that God's purpose was to have Israel subservient to the Babylonians for 70 years, and he also realizes that that time was just about at an end. And so he begins to pray and to confess the national sins of the people of Israel, and he gets a visitor from one of God's angels, who begins to unfold for him in a very detailed way God's purpose for the people of Israel. And he gives us this prophecy about the 70 weeks. He had just learned about 70 years and how that time of 70 years was almost over. But now he's going to learn about another time called the 70 weeks. And so the messenger tells Daniel this, 70 weeks are decreed about your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal both vision and prophet, and to anoint a most holy place. Well, just reading that description would sure make you want that 70 weeks to be up. I mean, to deal with sin totally, to finish transgression, put an end to sin. Yeah, I'm all about that. Let's do it right now. Okay, where's that 70 weeks? Where are we at in this calendar? I'd sure like to know. And so Daniel is given this wonderful prophecy that God has a calendar for the people of Israel, and it's 70 weeks long. 70 sevens, literally. 70 sevens. The next verse gives us a little bit more detail about when that calendar begins. He says, "So you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress." There's a lot of information given to us about that, but he gives us the starting point of the 70 weeks, and that is a decree to rebuild the city. A couple of clues there are that it's to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, not to rebuild the temple. We know there were several returns to Jerusalem. Cyrus the Great released the people of Israel to go back and begin rebuilding the temple. They didn't totally do it right away, and so Ezra, a little bit later on, had to go and help them. But it wasn't until Nehemiah was given permission by Artaxerxes to go back and rebuild the city walls that this prophecy begins. And that year, I'm getting a little ahead of myself here, but anyway, that year is 454 BC. But he tells us that that's the beginning point of the 70 weeks, from the decree to go rebuild the city, to rebuild the walls, the moats, and the whole city. And that it will then be 7 weeks and 62 weeks, which, do some quick math there. I still have a little COVID brain. Math is not coming easily to me right now. That's 69 weeks, right? 69 weeks. From the decree to rebuild the city until Messiah the Prince, there will be 69 weeks. 483 years in God's prophetic calendar for the people of Israel. And so we start to see that God does indeed have a time that he would call the fullness of time for the Messiah to come. Now, he does tell us that Jerusalem will be built again during that 69 weeks, but it will be times of distress. And if you've ever taken a little time to study the intertestamental histories, you'll find out it is very much a times of distress for Jerusalem. There were times they were free, there were times they were conquered again. It was very, very difficult for Jerusalem during that period. But from the decree to rebuild the walls and city until Messiah the Prince is 70 weeks, and 62 weeks, which equals 69 weeks, 69 sevens, 483 years. Well, let's go back to our statue and the histories of the nations here. The head of gold is Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar became king of the new Babylonian Empire in 605 BC. That lasted until 536. That was the event where Daniel says that King Belshazzar was giving a great feast and he saw the handwriting on the wall that said, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. That was the fall of the Babylonian Empire. That very night, Cyrus the Persian was able to divert the waters of the river that flowed underneath Babylon. Babylon was an impregnable city. The walls were 300 feet high, they were 60 feet thick, and there were two of them. So just in case you happened to get through the first one, you had to get through the second one. And the only weakness was that the river flowed right through under the wall through the city. It was heavily guarded, But because Belshazzar, the king, was throwing such an immense party, the guards were not at their posts, the gates were not lowered in their places, and Cyrus diverted the waters of the river so that he and his army could pass under the wall, and because the guards weren't at their place, nobody sounded the alarm. And because the gates were not closed, he was able to scale the sides of the riverbank and enter into the palace and take the city. God prepared Babylon for its own destruction. And he tells us in the book of Isaiah, several hundred years before it happened, I'm naming my man, Cyrus, by name, because the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. Well, when Babylon fell, Israel came under the control then of the Medo-Persian Empire, a series of kings who were pretty tolerant to the Jewish people. And so Persia allowed the people of Israel to return to Jerusalem and begin rebuilding the temple. In fact, Cyrus funded that out of the public coffers. Took the people of Israel a little while to do it, a lot of encouragement to do it. Ezra had to come back and kind of spur them along to do it, but they did. And finally, in 454 BC, we read of a man who is serving as a cupbearer to the king, and he's a Jewish man, and he hears about the state of Jerusalem, that the walls are still knocked down, the city is still lying in ruins, even though the temple has been rebuilt. And he petitions the king and says, I want to rebuild the city of my fathers. And so Artaxerxes, the king, gives Nehemiah permission to return to Jerusalem and rebuild the city walls. And that happens in 454. That becomes the starting point of our 70 weeks. From the decree to go rebuild the city of Jerusalem, we have 70 weeks, or 69 of them until Messiah the Prince is cut off. And so that begins in 454 BC, and you can read about that in the book of Nehemiah. Well, that calendar begins counting down, but God's purposes are not yet complete. The kingdom of Persia lasts for a couple of hundred years there, and some of their contributions to the history of the world are not just in allowing the Jewish people to return to their homeland, but also they began constructing a series of roads. They had one called the Royal Highway that stretched all the way from the coast of Turkey on the Aegean Sea all the way to the capital city of Susa. Stretched 1,600 miles. And it was said that a courier on horse could cross that in 9 days. Now that doesn't sound all that fast for us, because we simply click on the send button and our message can go anywhere in the world and to any number of people we want it to in a moment. But in the days before the internet, before Twitter and Facebook and all of those high-speed communications that we have, even before the postal service, you had the Persian Royal Road, and it was the quickest means of communication that the world had ever seen until that point. Only trouble was that if your couriers can travel it, guess who else can travel it? Your enemies. And so come along in 334 BC, and Alexander the Great crosses the Hellespont, which is the divider between Europe and Asia. And he begins bringing an army of about 50,000 troops. I mean, just 50,000. This is hard to imagine that this man does what he does with 50,000 troops. But over the next 10 years, Alexander is going to use portions of that royal road against the Persians, traveling, moving his armies very quickly. Here's a picture of the Greek Empire that Alexander builds. Most of the areas that aren't covered by Alexander's empire are desert. They're not inhabited by all that many people. And so while he didn't conquer the entire world, he conquered a huge, huge portion of it. All of this while the people of Israel are back at home, living in Jerusalem again. Many of them did stay in Babylon and in Persia. But as Alexander goes along, conquering everywhere, he doesn't just conquer the cities and the empires that he treads upon, but he begins transforming them. Everywhere he goes, he builds Greek-styled cities. He spreads Greek language. He spreads Greek law, Greek culture. They had a method of city planning that they used, and so Alexander would build colonies all over the place. And one of the things that that accomplished in the world was that by the end of Alexander's life, that entire colored area could speak one language. And that was nearly unheard of until then. Except unless, of course, you go back to the days of Babel. Alexander spread the Greek language everywhere. And so even if it wasn't your native tongue, you began to understand it. You began to be able to at least speak it as a trade language. And that sets the world up for a method of communication that was far more efficient than anything that had been used before. And that's going to become very, very important as the church is born. The message of Christ begins going out because guess what language the New Testament was written in? Greek. Alexander's Greek. The common Greek of the day. What was God accomplishing through that young man as he conquered the world? He was uniting the world with one language because there was a message God wanted the world to hear, and that was the message of his son. So the Persians began building roads to connect it. Alexander began connecting everything with one language. Well, that leaves us still with the legs of iron. Because in 64 BC, well, I guess the story of the Romans goes back a little farther than 64 BC. The city of Rome was founded in 753 BC. Right about the time the Assyrian Empire is starting to march onto the northern kingdom of Israel, getting ready to take Samaria and destroy it. According to legend, two brothers, Remus and Romulus, as babies, were expelled from their hometown, put into a basket, and set sail down the Tiber River. Their little basket was caught in the branches of a tree, and they were rescued by a she-wolf, who nursed them until they were grown. Later on, a farmer took them in and adopted them. Well, they went back to the area where they were first found in their basket, and they built the city of Rome after Romulus. Well, so says the legend. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. Stranger things have happened in the world, and so it's entirely possible. But that's the story of it. And so for a very long time, because Rome came through and conquered everything that Alexander had conquered and more, they reset the calendar and said, well, now we're going to start numbering things from the beginning of Rome. And so when you study ancient histories, you'll find continued references to the year after the founding of Rome. And so 753 becomes the beginning of that story. Rome kind of kept to itself until about the 3rd century when they decided they wanted to start expanding things. And so their legions began marching out from Rome and found almost nothing that could stop them. They invented a new style of soldier, the Roman legionnaire, and everybody had a very difficult time defeating the Romans. It reached its height at about 100 A.D., and covered as far north as Scotland, as far south as Egypt, as far east as Assyria. But one of the great contributions that the Romans made to the world at the time was a system of roads. You know, those red lines there are roads. Everywhere they went, they built roads. And not just little dirt trackways like some of the roads before them. These were well-engineered, paved roads with the proper slope to keep rainwater drained off of them. Made out of local materials most of the time, but stone. Travel on these roads was extremely efficient. The Roman legions could move from one end of the empire to the other in a little under a month, marching on foot. 250,000 miles of roads constructed by these Romans. Now, what did that facilitate for the world? So when the Roman Empire reaches its peak, right about the middle of the first century, and there is a little newborn group of people called the church, and they have a message they want to spread to the whole world, and guess what they have to do it? Beautifully paved roads. They can march anywhere in the known world on these Roman roads. And when they get there, they can still speak to you in Alexander's Greek and know that they'll be heard and understood. God was preparing the world. Well, even apart from that, back in Jerusalem, for all the contributions of these world empires, they were not great people. Most world empires tend towards tyranny. They tend to abuse their people. They tend to squander any wealth that they've created. And that was just as true for the Romans as it was for any other world empire. The Jewish people languished under that for quite a long time. They remembered the glorious days of David when their own empire stretched across the known world. They longed for the days of Solomon when there was peace. They looked to the days of Judas Maccabeus when they regained their freedom. And the heart of the Jewish people was learning to long to be free. And it was at that time that God said, "The fullness of times has come. It's time to send my son." He had prepared the world because he is the ruler and the sovereign over all nations. He'd prepped it with language. He'd prepped it with roads. He'd prepped it with peace. The Roman government, as brutal as it could be, was not a government that many people liked to go against. And so very often you could travel peaceably without fear of robbers, without fear of marauders, without fear of brigands. And because of what God accomplished through all of these empires, the world was set and ready to hear the message of Christ. But let's go back to Daniel's 70 weeks. Because as much as the history is fun to look into, it's fun to see what God was accomplishing. Sure is a whole lot more meaningful when God actually tells you what the time is. From the decree to rebuild the walls in the city until Messiah the Prince is 7 weeks and 62 weeks. So that's 69 weeks, 483 years. We've said that decree went forth in 454 to rebuild the walls. We know that Jesus was crucified in AD 30. We'll do a little math. 454 plus 30 is 484. And you say, wait a second, that's not 483. But don't forget, there is no year zero. You go from 1 BC to 1 AD. So we have to take away 1. 454 plus 30 minus 1 equals 483 years. God told us a long time ago what his prophetic calendar was. From the decree to rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince is cut off, there'll be 483 years. And there were. You say, well, what about the other 7 years? Aren't there seven more? Yeah, that's where the toes of iron and clay come in. That's for a time that hasn't yet begun yet. He tells us when that will begin, because there's coming a new ruler, a new world leader, another world empire. And we'll start counting off those 7 years when that rule, easy for you to say, when that world empire makes a covenant with the people of Israel for peace. And from that point, we'll mark off another 7 years. And then that rock that was made without hands that crushed the statue will do it. And Christ will rule. We look forward to that day, but we can look back with a great deal of confidence that God had sovereignly brought the world exactly where he wanted it to be, and he sent his son. Right at the fullness of times, right when his calendar said so, right according to his own timetable and his own purposes, And Christmas is a great reminder that God rules the world, that his purpose of history is to give all the kingdoms of the earth to his Son. We sing a song sometimes, "What Can I Give Him?" Because it's a great acknowledgement that we give presents at Christmas time, and it's fun. It's a good reminder of the present we've been given, the forgiveness, the redemption, the adoption as sons that Galatians talks about. But let every present also be a reminder that God is going to hand this world over to his Son and say, "Rule it. It's yours." And he will accomplish it, just like he did, accomplishing the fullness of times. So Dan is going to come and finish us up here this morning by leading us in another great Christmas song. Thou didst leave thy throne and thy kingly crown.
Hymnals, if you want to follow along as we stand, please.